last case this morning is 2019-182, the State of Ohio versus Roger Henderson. For the appellant, Mr. Martin.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. Your Honor, may I have 5 minutes for rebuttal? Revised Code Section 5145.01 cannot confer judicial authority on an employee of the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction. Yet effectively, that's what the 8th District says it can do. Because in this case, my client received a sentence of 18 years, an incorrect sentence of 18 years for murder when it should have been 18 to life, the other three being for the gun spec. And in litigating the issue of whether or not the trial court had the authority to resentence my client or sentence him anew, if you consider the first one to be a nullity, in September of 2017, the 8th District said he did not. Said no, he did not, because the original definite sentence was always an indefinite sentence by operation of law. So what the 8th District has held is that 5145.01 can constitutionally take a trial court's pronouncement of 18 years and it gets sent down to Columbus and it can get changed to 18 to life and we're done. That's the essence of the 8th District's holding. And the reason that's wrong is because 5145.01 cannot do that. We know that as a matter of basic separation of powers, that only a trial judge imposes a sentence. And for the executive branch to be able to change that and treat it differently than what the trial judge said violates separation of powers. So held this is no different than State versus Bodike in that regard.
Counsel, you agree there was a mistake?
Yes.
Okay.
I agree there was a mistake, but the mistake cannot be corrected by the executive branch.
Right.
And therein lies the problem for the state with respect to Proposition of Law 2. Now, with respect to Proposition of Law 1, the question becomes, okay, trial judges are human, they make mistakes. How long do we have to correct them? And this court should hold that you have, at the absolute outside, bright line, you can't wait any later than when two things have occurred. One, the state's right to appeal has already expired. And two, the defendant has served the amount of time that the trial judge told the defendant.
Why do we need to get to the second part? Why wouldn't we just say that the judge imposed a sentence, state didn't timely appeal? This is res judicata in the story.
Your Honor, I would submit to the court that you can do that, and the trial.
And in the process, we could just get rid of all this idea of void sentences. Anything wrong with that?
There is nothing wrong with that. In fact, the trial court said that he found that this sentence was voidable, and then he turned around and he imposed a sentence. Well, that shouldn't have happened. With all due respect to the trial court, that was an illogical consequence, because if something's voidable, then you only have the period of the appellate time to assert the error. If this court holds that this is a voidable sentence, and we have no objection if it does, and we would encourage the court to say so, then in fact the state missed the boat back in 1999, or the beginning of 2000, depending on what date in late 99 it was actually journalized.
At the original sentencing.
See, at the original, go ahead, Your Honor.
I mean, I'm trying to think if there would be enough there to put the state on notice that, because the plea colloquy took place and your client was told the real sentence that he would get, the legal sentence, 15 to life, right, during the plea colloquy.
Your Honor, he was told that the sentence for murder was 15 to life. I'm not willing to concede that that necessarily put him on notice that it was an indefinite sentence. If a judge says, your sentence for murder is 15 to life plus 3 for the gun spec, so you're looking at 18 to life, a reasonable person might very well say, okay, so I could get 20, I could get 25, they could give me all the way up to the rest of my life. And so in that sense, there is some ambiguity, but it's not necessary for this court to resolve that for purposes of this appeal. And so for purposes of your question, Your Honor, yes, he was told 15 to life.
15 life. And so the judge misspoke at the sentencing and forgot to put that tail on, just said 18 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
And is the state supposed to be on notice right then that that's an issue that they have to take up on appeal? I mean, busy trial courts have 10 to 15 sentencing hearings a day, and they're supposed to catch that and take that up on appeal, and if not, then the defendant gets the benefit of a flat sentence, an illegal sentence?
Several aspects to Your Honor's question. I want to make sure I get them all.
Okay.
All right. The prosecutor was there when the words 18 years were pronounced and said nothing. A journal entry was prepared and sent, presumably, to the prosecutor's office. They had the opportunity to read it. They did nothing. 30 days passed. They took no appeal. And so if this court holds that this type of a sentence is voidable, that is all it takes. And that's not asking too much, any more than you ask any other litigant to pay attention in court to what is said and read the journal entry when you're done. You know,
what happens if somebody's over-sentenced and the appellate court, defendant's attorney misses it, prosecutor doesn't do anything about it? Are we in the same boat?
No, Your Honor, because you have a due process violation. And of course, the state does not have due process rights, but defendants do. You would have a due process violation if a criminal defendant were being held longer than the statutory time. Now, this court.
What's the remedy there? Habeas?
The remedy could be habeas, or the remedy could be to come back to the court for a sentencing de novo that the original sentence was illegal and violative of the 14th Amendment. Now, this court has in the past treated these types of sentences that are outside of statutory parameters, going back at least as far as State versus Beasley, not as voidable, but as void. And in treating them as void, this court has said it's a nullity, and therefore it can be corrected at any time. But even then, under this court's void jurisprudence, due process tells us that there comes a limit. You can't say the sentence was void, Rogers Henderson gets out at 18 years, he goes about his life for the next 30, and then somebody corrals him, brings him back to court, and says, hey, sentence was void. We get to do, you know, you haven't been sentenced yet. We understand that would have to violate due process. We also understand that if this mistake had been caught the next day, or during the period of time of the appeal, that there would be no due process violation. So where do we draw that line between one day and 30 years outside of prison? And the place to draw that line is when you have done the time that the judge said you were supposed to do, and the state and the state's period for an appeal has already expired. That's why in Beasley, yes, Your Honor.
The state attempted to get the trial court to correct it before he was released, right?
Your Honor, in 2011, some 11 years after Rogers had already started, the state filed a motion for a correction of the sentence. The trial court never ruled on it. The state never followed up.
But that's the trial court's fault, right? The state?
Your Honor, litigants have to be able to assert and have a responsibility to assert their rights in a timely fashion. And, you know, there are, we can talk about this in terms of forfeiture. We can talk about this in terms of missing deadlines and the like. And so, you know, trial judges make mistakes, but that's the reason why there's other people that are in the courtroom as well, and you're supposed to be taking care of your client.
Well, okay, but so the state, but the state did bring this to the court's attention.
It did in 2011, 12 years later, and then didn't do anything about it. But before that happened, in 2009, my client actually brought to the court's attention, hey, they're telling me I'm going to get PRC. I shouldn't be getting PRC. And twice he brought it to the court's attention and he filed motions with the trial court. The state...
Counsel, did he do that pro se?
He did.
Okay,
he did.
So clearly he did have an expectation of finality, which is one of the arguments that if you're subject to a void sentence, you shouldn't have the expectation of finality because it's a void sentence. But here, obviously, your client was pretty comfortable with that 18 years if he's going to go back to the court and say, you know, I get a flat 18 and I've got no, you know, once I get released, you've got nothing on me.
Well, although, Your Honor, his pleadings do actually talk also about the idea of a life tale. But here's, I didn't advise him to file that motion, Your Honor. Now, that having been said, you file that motion, though, if you're Rogers Henderson. And the state turns around in its response on April 22nd, 2009, and says, what are you talking about? You got 18 flat. And then the trial court turns around and denies that motion on June 29th, 2009. So here's a defendant who says, don't I have 18 a life? And the prosecutor says, no, you don't. And the trial judge says, the prosecutor's right. Now, my client's somewhat persistent. He filed a second one that raised the same issue. And once again, it was denied. Now, when we're talking about an expectation of finality, remember, I talked about 18 years, you know, serving the fully served term as the outside limit. But this court can find under the facts of this case, because due process is a fact-centered issue in many cases, that even before that bright line, back in 2009, 2010, if you've twice said to the court, you sure this is right? And the prosecutor has said, shut up. You get what you get and you don't get upset. And then turns around and the trial court says, you're right, twice says, no, now your sentence is fine. At that point, an expectation of finality has to crystallize. If my client can't be expected to trust the word of the trial judge and the prosecutor, then who is he supposed to trust? And at some point, fundamental fairness says to the state, you're bound by your words. You're bound by your inaction. You're bound by the fact that you sat on your hands. You know, in some ways, this is a case where the shoe's on the other foot. How many times, correctly so, has the state of Ohio and courts throughout the state of Ohio said to a criminal defendant, nice argument, you waited too long to bring it, and we're not going to consider it. People have remained in prison. People have gone to their deaths with those unheard arguments. And yet today, the state, in effect, invites you to say, don't measure us by the same measure we would have you use against a criminal defendant. Due process tells us that cannot be the law. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my time.
Thank you. Mr. Shaffer.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Cuyahoga County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Greg Ochocki on behalf of the appellee of the state of Ohio. Before I begin, I would like to address a couple of factual inaccuracies in my colleague's oral argument, and they concern Mr. Henderson's pro se motions. The first motion that Mr. Henderson filed in March of 2009 did not mention his void sentence. What he argued is that post-release control was not imposed on his sentence. The state opposed that motion, said, you're right, There was no, but there's no post-release control in the journal entry. In August of 2009, Mr. Henderson filed a second pro se motion. In his second pro se motion, he argued that his sentence, he knew his sentence was void. He said, I pled guilty to murder. My sentence should be 18 years to life. The state did not oppose that motion, contrary to what my colleague said. The state did not respond. The trial court denied it without the state's response. Subsequently, 2 years later, the state filed a similar motion saying this man's sentence is illegal. It's contrary to law. And the trial court never ruled on it. Fast forward to...
And the state never filed a writ to compel the court to rule on it.
We did not, Your Honor. Subsequently, the trial court filed, or I'm sorry, the state filed a second motion for resentencing in September of 2017. While Mr. Henderson was still serving his illegal definite prison sentence.
Let's talk about the release date issue a little
bit.
After all those hearings in September, the 8th District ruled he should have been awarded 71 days, so release date, according to them, should have been September 16th, well, right? And I know that was entered later, but the state didn't appeal it, did they?
No, we did not, Your Honor.
So we're bound by that finding?
At that time, Your Honor, because the sentence had been converted to the proper indefinite sentence, those jail time credit days only went towards Mr. Henderson's eligibility for parole. He was eligible for parole in September.
I'm asking a different question. Is it law of the case that the release date, at least at that point, should have been September 16th of 2017?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because at that point, the 8th District said that the sentence was an indefinite sentence. And since it was an indefinite sentence based on the statute, the 5145.01.
Well, when did the Court of Appeals say that?
In its
The date.
The date the Court of Appeals said that? I don't have the date of the entry.
Was it prior to the calculation of 9/16/17?
Well,
the date that Justice Fisher gave you is September 16th, 2017.
Correct.
Prior to that, the 8th District confirmed that it was an 18 to life plus 3 sentence.
No, it did not, Your Honor.
Okay, I think that's what...
Right. So, what I'm saying is when the correction was made, that was after the Court of Appeals made the September 16th time. That was after he had served his 18 years?
It was after he had served his 18 years, but it was not after he had served his sentence because...
I understand the legal aspect, but he had served the 18 years. It was after the time that the Court of Appeals said was his date, the September 16th date. Or September 19th date, one of those, right? And so I guess what we're figuring out here is it's agreed that he was not sentenced properly, but how long is that window open for a proper sentence?
Well, the state's position is that he was still serving that indefinite, he was still serving his definite sentence.
Not according to anything on paper, not according to the journal entry, not according to any appellate court decision, not according to anything was he serving that 18 to life.
According to revised code 5145.01, the indefinite sentence, which was inadvertently, the definite sentence, which was inadvertently entered on the journal entry was an indefinite sentence, was to be treated as
regardless
an indefinite sentence.
Regardless of what sentence. The trial court in the journal entry says.
Yes, Your Honor, because the trial court was not authorized to issue a definite sentence for murder.
Well, if the time this was, the calculation was being done, the only issue before the court was how much credit he was supposed to get in days from off the sentence, correct?
At the September 2017.
After he served his 18 years, what was before the court was, because at that point it still hadn't been determined by any court order, that says he has 18 to life, correct? Or 15 to life plus 3?
That's correct, okay. Your Honor.
So when he's before the court and the 8th District rules that the release date should have been 9/16/17, they're only arguing about credit, you know, in days, right?
Yes,
they're not arguing about the big picture sentence, because everybody's still under the impression he's an 18-year definite.
I would disagree. Are you talking about the Court of Appeals, Your Honor? I would disagree, because the Court of Appeals determined that his sentence was always indefinite. Therefore,
the Court of Appeals what?
The Court of Appeals determined under the statute 5145.01 that his sentence was always an indefinite sentence, even though it said definite.
When did the Court of Appeals say that?
In the same opinion that it granted him the jail time credit.
Okay.
So if you have an indefinite sentence, the Court of Appeals said that his sentence was indefinite back to at the time it was entered incorrectly. And when you have an indefinite sentence, that jail time credit goes towards the day he's eligible for parole, which would have been at least a year and a half prior to the Court of Appeals decision.
Counsel, that's why I was asking. When the Court of Appeals found 71 days, mm-hmm. okay, was that issue ever appealed?
No, it was not, Your Honor, because at that time, the Court of Appeals determined that Mr. Henderson's sentence was always an indefinite sentence.
Under 5145?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the issue of 71 days was never appealed?
It was not, because because the sentence was always considered an indefinite sentence, those jail time credit days go towards parole eligibility.
Correct.
Parole eligibility was back in September of 2017. We're in 2018, 2019, when the Court of Appeals issues its opinion. So the only issue, and in fact, the issue regarding the issue regarding the jail time credit would have been moot by that time.
Well, they entered the opinion, though, right?
I know they did, Your Honor, but...
And it wasn't appealed.
Well, an appeal would have been moot because he had already...
If you disagreed with it, though, it could have affected when Mr. Henderson was released, on parole or otherwise. Correct?
Arguably correct.
So it wasn't appealed.
I'm sorry?
So that issue is law of the case.
The issue of...
71 days.
The jail time credit is law of the case, Your Honor.
Okay.
Well, why isn't this case just a lot simpler? The court held a sentencing hearing, put on a sentencing entry, it sent the sentencing entry, presumably the prosecutor's office. Prosecutor's office chose not to appeal. The entry said 15 years. Why shouldn't that just be res judicata at the end of the case?
Because under this court's precedent law, going back to as far as Beasley, as my colleague said, that a court is not authorized to sentence someone to a sentence that's not authorized by law.
Well, correct.
That makes it a void sentence.
Well, but I mean, I don't know if your prosecutor's office has, but I've certainly seen a lot of prosecutor's office, the state attorney general, argue that we should get rid of that idea that sentencing errors make a sentence void. So wouldn't this be a good case to do that?
I would disagree, Your Honor, because of the fact that the trial court never had authority to issue a definite sentence.
But trial courts do things without authority all the time. They make errors during trial, they make mistakes, and ordinarily, sometimes they violate people's constitutional rights. But ordinarily, if the state doesn't appeal, then that's the end of it. Why should this be any different?
Because, Your Honor, this does not violate Mr. Henderson's due process rights. Mr. Henderson...
Well, that's not the question. The question is, trial courts make errors all the time, right? Trial court can deny someone their constitutional rights, for example. And if the state doesn't timely... Or if the losing party doesn't timely appeal, that's generally the end of the matter. Why shouldn't that apply here? I mean, if the state was really worried about it, they could have appealed, right?
If the state would have appealed under the case law, Beasley and the progeny, the appeal would have been dismissed because there's not a final appealable order. It's
what?
A void judgment.
What are you talking? You think if the state would have appealed the sentencing entry, it would have been dismissed for lack of a final appealable order?
I do, Your Honor. I think it would have been remanded.
Do you have any precedent for that?
I do not, but I think, Your Honor, the appellate court would have remanded it. The trial court would have looked at the sentence.
Whether remanded or whether brought up on appeal would have been corrected.
Understood, Your Honor. But okay. the mechanism in place for a void sentence.
Can you cite me one case where an appeal was dismissed for lack of a final order in that situation?
I cannot, Your Honor. Yeah.
Think that would have happened here, though.
I do, based on the fact that it's there was not a final appealable order. There was not a sentence that was imposed according to law.
So he has been held illegally all this time, then?
He hasn't been held illegal.
Well, there's no final judgment. He shouldn't. He can't hold someone without a final judgment, can you?
He got, Your Honor, Mr. Henderson received credit for his time that he served under the illegal sentence towards his parole eligibility.
Is Mr. Henderson still being held?
He is, Your Honor. I believe he's already had his first parole hearing, and his parole was continued.
So how long has he been incarcerated?
He's been incarcerated since December of 1999. I think it was December 2nd was the day he was shipped to the institution.
Well, but he was incarcerated prior to that, the jail time credit.
He was incarcerated.
Okay, so yes. How long has that been?
Since, I believe it's September 22nd of 1999.
So over 20 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, so I can get over here, get my record straight. When the state moved on September 15th, 2017, for a new resentencing hearing, it believed the release date was September 19th, correct? The way I read that pleading.
No, the Department of Corrections stated that the release date was September 21st.
21st, and that's why the hearing was set for the 20th?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Your Honor, if there are no further questions, I would just ask that this court affirm the 8th District's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Martin, you have a little over a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. It's been over 20 years for Rogers Henderson, and he still sits in prison.
But, counsel, if the sentence was 18 to life, 15 to life plus 3,
yes,
and he was still sitting there after 20 years, and he did a parole hearing, and they denied it, and they pushed it the date down, you'd have no complaint here.
That's correct.
Okay. So you're saying that it's unfair because the court got it wrong to begin with. It's been reviewed several times by a courts of appeal. Nobody noticed it. The state didn't appeal. So he gets the benefit of the mistake.
He gets...
Of the initial mistake of a flat sentence. He gets the benefit of that.
He gets the benefit of the mistake because he has the protection of the Due Process Clause. That's the thing about this. There's the expectation of finality that comes from the fact. And so it's not a question of, this isn't about a judge's mistake. This is about the expectation of finality that my client has in being able to walk into a court of law, hear a judge say a sentence, and expect that will be the sentence.
Well, but isn't this really more about the failure of that mistake to be corrected in the time frame allowed for it to be corrected?
And
It is about that. It's about the state's inability to correct this mistake, and therefore,
but they did
that,
try.
They tried.
They tried to do that. Doesn't this? We both come from Cuyahoga County, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so, isn't this stem from the fact that in 34 courtrooms in a murder sentencing, the judges use, some judges will say 15 to life, some will say life with possibility of parole in 15, and in this case, someone just forgot to say, just said 18. This is what it come from. So the state necessarily wouldn't have been, you're right, in a perfect world, they should have stood up and said, wait a minute, judge, you forgot about the tail. They didn't. But they tried to get the trial court to correct this in a reasonable time, why he was serving his sentence, and the trial court just ignored the state's motion.
Several aspects to Your Honor's question again. First, in 2009, the state of Ohio told the trial court, this sentence is correct. Second.
Incorrectly, they said that, right?
Incorrectly, they said that, all right? But now my client's relying on the executive branch and the judicial branch. At that point, a due process expectation has crystallized. Once it's crystallized, we're done. To the extent, though, that the state tries to then reopen the book in 2011 and sits on its hands when nobody rules on its motion until it waits until the 11th hour, except that it was the 11th hour, it wasn't the 11th hour, it was just past midnight. And that was their problem, is that the jail time credit that my client had coming actually showed that he should have been out already when we sat in that courtroom on September 20th. And he had made motions for that jail time credit, and we made a motion for that jail time credit that day, and it even said at 41 of the transcript that we wanted the court to rule on our jail time credit motion first before we got to the issue of resentencing. The trial court refused to do so. Mike, and one of the things I would point out is this too, as far as when that jail time credit gets imposed. It doesn't matter. My client has an equal protection right to the jail time credit. You can't turn around and say, well, because we didn't acquit him of his equal protection rights under Fugate with respect to jail time credit, he doesn't have a due process right expectation of finality. You can't say that due process doesn't kick in because the state's busy violating equal protection at the same time. That can't work. The bottom line here, Your Honor, is this. Yes, everybody's busy, okay? And no, the system's not perfect. But there has to come a time when every party is accountable for what they have and have not done. I mean, we could say the same thing if Mr. Henderson had been allowed out. And 10 years down the road, he was brought in. We could still sit there and say, well, the state of Ohio, you know, really, this case is no different in that posture than it is in his current posture. Whether he had gotten out the door when he should have on September 16th, or whether he was being held illegally on September 20th, the fact of the matter is there has to be a moment of finality. And that moment of finality comes when the state has not appealed during its allotted time, and you have served the entire sentence that the judge has said could be served. Yes, it is two words. Mark Twain told us that the only difference between lightning and a lightning bug is one. Words matter. Words that are part of orders matter. And when you journalize that entry and you speak through those words, they matter. And when you don't turn around in a timely fashion to try to get something corrected because you think it doesn't matter until that point, you're wrong, and you violated my client's rights to due process. And when that happens, this court has to turn around and act accordingly. And for 514501 to try to save this is to say,
Counsel, yes. When do we stop, the line for correcting something? Is it just dictated by the time allotted to the state to appeal here? You know, not just with your client. It's been said here that judges make mistakes all the time. It's a busy docket day. They forget to say the tail, whatever happens. When does the mistake become reality? In other words, not void, not voidable. It's etched in stone.
At the very outside, it is etched in stone no later than when you have served the entire sentence that the client, that the court imposed, and the state has had its 30 days to appeal go by. And the reason you have to add that part is because if my client had gotten probation, or let's say my client had gotten time served, of course, the time served, I couldn't sit here and say to you, I have an expectation of finality because we've already finished. They get their 30 days, okay? And so, therefore, that's the outside point, Your
so
Honor.
So that's but what you're saying, that if the sentence is served in its entirety, as voiced from the bench and in the journal entry, then no matter how wrong it is, there's no recourse for the state to come to the court and get a resentencing or an addition. I see that, you know, the complaint about the executive branch intervening here and doing what it did, but I'm interested in the court's power.
That is the limit of the court's power.
Okay. And because the time served here, I mean, the argument over the couple days, one way or the other,
yes, sir,
because that had passed. Had he had less days of credit and that date of the 20th was not the drop-dead date in your scenario, had he had till the 21st, or excuse me, the 25th, and this was done on the 20th, you wouldn't be here.
Your Honor,
we might be here, but you might not be in such a, you know, the position you're arguing.
Your Honor, in terms of that absolute bright line, I would not be able to invoke it. However, in this case, under the unique circumstances of this case, where my client had been told during the intervening period that his sentence was correct, at least once by the prosecutor, and twice by the court in denying motions. In this particular case, that due process expectation of finality actually crystallized before the final bright line, and it crystallized back in 2010 after the trial court had twice denied motions that he had raised with respect to the sentencing. But in every case, the bright line comes at the point where the sentence that has been stated has been served in full. The federal courts have looked upon this not necessarily as a due process right, but also as a double jeopardy right, that the multiple punishment clause of the double jeopardy clause would be the is their recourse. And those cases are collected in People versus Williams, which is a case that we've cited in our reply brief.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshal, adjourn court, please.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.